it's wonderful of you to let me come. And I hope we have a time, you know, when we just don't have a pep rally, but we have a pit stop. Because most of us in a hard race, and we need to run into the pits every once in a while. We get some new tires, and we get some new fuel, and we get some new lubricants. And then we go out, and we go back on the track to run the race. And so we're here really to learn from each other. You know, when we talk about growth, I'm sure you believe like I do, that growth isn't numerical. That's only one phase of growth. The real growth in a church comes in the growth in vitality. Is your church more vital this year than they were last year? Now, if they were, if they are, then you've got growth, and you've got the right kind of growth. Now, not only in vitality, but in depth. Are your people deeper than they have been? This is our function, to give our people vitality and depth. I was reading a writer the other day. She said a wonderful thing. She said, I would hate to get to the end of a long life and realize I only had length, I didn't have breadth. And I see people who are not developing breadth in their life. And this is the thing that we need to get to. Frank Barker, I ran into him the other day, you know, the pastor of Briarwood in Birmingham. And I have such respect for him. He's grown such a, you know, huge church. But one of his members was telling me that for 6 months, Frank has been getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning and having breakfast with a non-believer. That's Frank's strength. That's where it starts, the concern for people. I've had a wonderful experience the last 3 or 4 weeks of attending 3 different churches that are very different. We were down at Coral Ridge Presbyterian. And what a marvelous experience, you know, huge church, great ritual. The ushers wearing gray tuxedos. I thought what a marvelous place to be have a funeral. You know, you know, if I die, I would like to, you know, go down there and maybe have those fellows to work on it. Wonderful church. Then I went over to the Teach Ziggs class over at the First Baptist Church in Dallas. 28,000 members. I'm not sure they could find them all, but they've got them on the list. And you know, here they have kneeling rails. I mean, you've got to be almost wishing to be an Episcopalian in a Southern Baptist church to install kneeling rails. It's kind of interesting to hear all the creaking knees as these old folks try to get down there on those kneeling rails. You know, I think we have to be very careful that we don't use some things as gimmicks. I know one church school that taught that you get all the deacons to come down and kneel, and that's where the power comes from. I happen to know the church was in a fight, and here were all those hypocrites down there kneeling together, you know, and wouldn't even speak. You expect God almost to say, get up from there. You cut out the games. It's not a gimmickry that we have. Then the third church I went to, which I enjoyed very much, a little bitty church. We have a place down on Padre Island. A little bitty church, average membership, 58. What a wonderful experience. Preacher stands there in a sports shirt and shakes hands with people who come in. Then he goes over and puts on a cheap robe. Doesn't change a bit. Gets up in the pulpit, just same guy he was, standing over there shaking hands. It always bothers me when a fellow, you know, speaking to you before the service and goes into a seminary brogue when he gets on the platform. That always bothers me. He was just an ordinary sort of a guy. Here we had about 58 people. I counted the house. Over in the corner, about 5 or 6, 7 kids just jumping up and down like grease on a skillet. And I said to myself, man, I don't believe I'm going to be able to stand this. And all of a sudden, he said, fellowship time. All these kids started running around hugging the old people. Never saw it done before in my life. What a wonder. I bet there are a lot of old people who go to church just to have those kids hug them. I mean, it kind of got contagious, and I noticed even people hugging each other. I said to myself, that's great. Then they left for their own little church where they weren't disturbing people. He got up and he said, we've been praying for Aunt Molly's husband, and he's died. Now let's pray for Aunt Molly. So they prayed for Aunt Molly. And he said, then after he did, he said, are there any other prayers? Little boy, about 5 years old, I guess. He spoke to him. He said, my dog died Thursday. You know what we ought to have done? We ought to stop right then and prayed for that boy. There's nothing could happen to a kid any worse than have his dog die. And he ought to learn that when you have a sorrow, you bring it to the church. And we care. But instead, there was just that embarrassed silence. Oh, we ought to stop. In another little church. Now, I'm attending small churches for a reason. I'm writing an article on God Bless the Small Church. It's coming out in Leadership Magazine. Because I think we've given so much attention to big churches. They've gotten a lot of ink, you know. They've gotten, and they deserve it. They're wonderful things. But a lot of wonderful Christians are worshiping in small churches. And I'm going to write an article on God Bless the Small Church. It's coming out, I think, in the next issue of Leadership. And I went to this small church, and here was this great big bruiser of a construction man sitting on the front row. Had a three-year-old daughter in his lap, fidgeting around, you know. Six-year-old son sitting beside him, playing with his big black King James Bible, the only, you know, edition of the authentic scripture. And and, you know, I looked over and I said to myself, they're not even big enough to have a choir. They haven't got a youth program. But here's a couple of kids who are going to grow up knowing that the faith is important to their father. And they're going to remember sitting in his lap and playing with his Bible. And I don't know, but what that's awfully good training, awfully good start for those kids. And so I'm looking forward to continued. You know, one of the things I've been writing, you know, for Leadership Magazine, I've been speaking to ministers' conferences, and as a businessman, one of the things I've been surprised about, I've been surprised at how deep the depression is in the ministry. I don't want you to hold up your hands, but the depression is very deep in the ministry, and I'm concerned about it. And I think these are the kind of things we need to do to help each other to come out of this thing. I was going through a little bitty town going towards South Texas. You know, these little towns where you have, you know, just one traffic light. You know, the welcome and hurry back on the same sign. And and I stopped in. You know, they always have a one big church. They always have one cafeteria. You know, Sue's or Mary's or somebody's. And so I stopped in at Sue's to have a cup of coffee with my wife. And here sat that old cowboy over there, those boots and big hat on, and he looked at me two or three times, and he walked over and said, ain't you Fred Smith? Well, I said, you know, thank you for reminding me, because I do forget from time to time. I said, yeah, I am, cowboy. Who are you? Well, he said, I read your stuff in Leadership. I said, you do? I said, who are you? Well, he said, see that church over there? I'm pastor. Well, I said, man, that's a big church. He said, yeah. I said, I was saved as a cowboy, and I still am one. I said, how you doing, preach? Well, he said, just fine. We just finished a revival. Had a group from the West Coast came up and really pepped us up and said, we really did great. I said, boy, am I happy to see you. I've been talking to so many depressed preachers. I'm glad to see one. It's really on top. He got right quiet, and he said, you want the truth? I said, but don't give it to me all at one time, but, you know. Well, he said, next Sunday I'm resigning, and I'm joining another denomination. He said, my wife's divorcing me. We stayed and had dinner with him. Just wanted to talk to a man who's hurting and who needs help. I one time said to a group I was speaking to at Pastor's Conference at Billy Graham Center, and I said to him, said, on Monday at the Preacher's Conferences, why do you get together and lie to each other? You know, why can't you really be honest? We got to get in there and say, you know, God's really blessing us. Boy, the Spirit poured out on us. You know what I'm saying to me? He said, you're asking us to commit professional suicide. To be honest with each other. I hope here we can find a level of honesty as we talk and as we visit with each other. Can I give you a phrase that means so much to me? I've been going around with some preachers who are extremely vital right now. They're in prison ministry. They're former convicts. And as I watch these fellows, I realize one thing. They see the power and they feel the joy. Would you write that down? Just see the power and feel the joy. This is what gets us depressed. We don't see the power and we don't feel the joy. I'm talking about the power of God in lives. For example, let me tell you, I was with the other day a small group of friends, and we had one of the men from Indonesia there. Young man who had been born on an island of 400 people. You could walk around the island 6 hours. No education. Had to go 2 weeks to another island just to get a little schooling. Became a Christian. Chris has now built 3,000 churches. Small churches. But he's built 3,000 churches. What a wonderful time to spend 3 days just because why? He says, I see Christ converting the Muslim. See, that takes the power of God. That doesn't come by argument. That didn't come by intelligence. That comes by the power of God. And so he said, you know, I see the power and I feel the joy. And if you don't see the power, you can't feel the joy. I could give you a person. I had lunch 2 weeks ago. Man, I'd never had lunch with. I'd met him. He had a wonderful, radiant face. He said, do you want to know my background? He said, I'm an illegitimate half-breed. I was sold on the black market. The ones who bought me were going to sell me again and nobody would buy me. And I was raised in an abused child. He said, at 8 years old, I went to a Salvation Army meeting and I became a Christian. Today, he's a wonderful minister. He adopted a son. And the son said to him the other day, Dad, when I get married, I'm going to adopt a boy so I can pass the love on to him that you've passed on to me. That's the power of God. That isn't human power. And so when you see the power, you feel the joy. A professor friend of mine called me and he said, Fred, for 30 years you've known me as a drunk Catholic, PhD in university. He said, I'm now a sober Catholic. I started to say, well, thank you for not joining the Baptist church. We've already got enough dreary sober Baptists. He said, I want to come talk to you. He came to Dallas. I met him in the Hilton Hotel. He said, can we hug? He said, we've been friends for 30 years now. We're brothers. And so we hugged. And he's in the family. See, when I look at a man that's been drinking a fifth of liquor for 30 years, I'm looking at the power of God. Yeah. I'm not looking at arguments. And so when you see the power, you feel the joy. I had dinner back in December with Murph the Surf, the famous jewel thief. 21 years in penitentiary. Somebody went and said, Jesus loves you. It went through those bars and pulled Murph out. Murph today is a wonderful Christian minister. That takes power. That takes power. He said an interesting thing. He said, Fred, you and I will be going back into the prisons and talking. And said, they'll be a little rough on me, or they'll put me in a bus and it's not air conditioned, and they'll put the counselors in a room where they're sweating. He said, I always turn to him. I say, hey, my brothers, there's no blessings in the comfort zone. No, there are no blessings in the comfort zone. The blessings are on the uncomfortable. I had an employee who, first time I talked to her, 40 years ago, she said to me that some people are going to hell and some people are going to heaven. I'm going to hell. It was just that flat. I got a letter from her the other day. Somewhere along the way, she found Christ. And she said, I'm now 79 years old. I'm happy to stay, but I'm ready to go. See, that takes the power. And as long as you can see the power, you can feel the joy. But if you don't see the power, you can't feel the joy. You know, I know that we're going to be getting more than a bag of tricks here or a bunch of gimmicks. I don't believe we worship a God of gimmicks. I don't believe that. I don't believe we can do little simple things and bring his power. I simply have found in my study that every command involves a process. Every command involves a process. And we have to live through that process. I don't believe in praying for miracles where God has given a process. Yes, I believe in miracles, but God operates mostly by process. Can I suggest this? The number one thing we do in our life is that we set a direction, not just a goal. Zig asked me to teach his class on this point. He said, the important thing in life is to have a direction before you have a goal. I see people who talk all the time about goals. Goals are important, but goals are not as important as direction. What's the direction of your life? Let me give you this suggestion. The direction for our life should be, who are we becoming? Who are we becoming? At Leadership Magazine, we get more letters on the one subject than any other from preachers. And that is, I'm not happy with what my job is doing to me. I'm not happy with who I'm becoming in this. I talked to a preacher the other day, and he said, you know, in order to pastor my church, I have to sell a part of my soul. I'm not going to be pious and say you can't do that. What we have to say is our direction. Who am I becoming? 10 years from now, 20 years from now, who am I going to be? It's important. See, it's important that we not let our function use up our person. I see it in business all the time. A man will retire as vice president. He's a hollow man because he let his function use up his person. The title was important. The prestige was important. The limousine, the jet. These things became his function, not his person. Yesterday morning, I ran into Roger Staubach for breakfast. And I said, Roger, remember we wrote the last chapter of your book? He asked me to help him on the last chapter. And I said to him, Roger, what do you want to do? What do you want to say? He said, I want to say that as I retire as a quarterback, I'm more than a retired quarterback. I'm a person. And of course, what a success story his life has been. I was at a radio dinner, and one of our well-known radio personalities was being introduced, a woman. And as she was being introduced very wonderfully, she turned to me and whispered, I feel such a phony. I got to thinking about it. Everything they said about her was absolutely true. Everything they said. You know why she felt phony? Because her talent was so much bigger than a person. Her talent was so much bigger than a person. Mozart had this problem, didn't he? He was a small, mean guy, but God poured great music through him. Oftentimes, our ministry is God using us way beyond who we are. And we can't get depressed about that. We just simply have to be grateful that he uses us. And we can't be phony and say, well, I'm going to act as big as my talent. We just have to. Let me give you the best definition of humility I ever heard. Humility is not denying the power that you have, but admitting the power comes through you and not from you. I'll repeat that. Humility is not denying the power that you have, That's lying. But it's admitting that it comes through you and not from you. And so we can't be many times as big as our talent, but we don't have to be. I was talking to a doctor who had an international reputation. He'd become quite a heavy drinker. And I tried this out on him. I told him the story of this lady saying she was such a phony, and he jumped up from the table. He said, "That's it, that's it." And I realized that he had a much greater talent than he was a person. If God's given you the talent, use it, but also bring the person along to match up with it. Let me suggest two things. And I'm going to break my talking down into three parts. The person and family of the leader, the qualities of the leader, and the skills of the leader. Now, they will overlap some, but it just makes it easier. I wanted to get away from those titles that I'd turned in because they were speeches I'd heard that were awfully good, but I couldn't use them. Let's take the person. Number one is, what's your purpose? What's your purpose in life? You say to glorify God. That's a little too broad. What is a church for? A church is to do three things as I see it. Number one, to reach the lost. One of the problems I see today is that the world, the media, the world, is trying to say that our agenda is the poor. No, our agenda is not the poor. Our agenda is the lost. They're talking as if they weren't poor, you wouldn't have any place for the church. There are just as many lost people who are rich as who are poor. And so Christ left us with the agenda of the lost, not the poor. Poor, yes, we want to take care of as a secondary, but not the major thrust of our church is not the poor. It is not the suffering. When this war started, they asked one of the theologians, they said, "Whose side will God be on?" And he said, "I don't know which nation, but he'll always be on the side of the suffering." That's not good theology. That's not good theology. It's good social conversation. But the theology is that God is always on the side of the lost. I asked people and laymen, I said, "Do you believe Christ came as a sacrifice or an example?" This seems to me to separate people. If he came as a sacrifice, that means we have him located right. If he came as an example, I didn't need Christ to come as an example. Everybody who's better than I am is an example. I've got examples all around me. I know a lot of people better than I am. He didn't need to come as a perfect man and inundate me as an example. But number one, it's the lost. Number two, it's the maturity. This is where small church can do such a great job in maturing people because you know people. I say to businesses when I'm talking to small businessmen, I say, if you got 10 people in your business, do you realize how much more important every one is than in a company that's got 1,000 people? See, if you got 1,000 people, one person isn't that important, actuarially, because that's one out of 1,000. But if you got 10 people, one person is extremely important. So the smaller your organization, the more important each individual becomes. And the maturity, I say to our people in Dallas, look, God's not interested in your success. He's interested in your maturity. And many times it takes failure to keep us mature. Maturity is based on obedience, isn't it? This is it. I see an awful lot of wasted Bible study because people who have decided they're not going to obey the part they know, there's no point in them learning more. And we can't impress God by how much we know and weigh it against what we're not going to do. Our disobedience is where we come into issue. The third thing, and that is fellowship. The lost, the maturity, and the fellowship. You know, so often we find our fellowship and our suffering, and it contributes so much to our life. I have a preacher friend who's pastor of a large church. I was on a retreat with him, and somebody said to him, how long have you been pastor of your church? He said, 3 years. Oh, he said, I had the impression you'd been there many years. Said, I have. Said, I've been senior minister for 15 years, but I've only been pastor 3 years. When my wife left me and my son was killed, I became pastor. Before he'd been senior minister. Now, out of his suffering, he found, I've been studying Spurgeon. Do you realize that Spurgeon preached out of his suffering? The man died at 57. He had gout, which always seemed to be kind of social climbing for a Baptist. But but he had rheumatoid gout. He would have to lay in bed a whole week and never move a muscle because of the pain. This man preached with gout in his knees. His wife was an invalid from the time she was 33 years old. He had deep depressions, which he fought through. It was out of this that he became the great preacher. And so it's in our suffering that we oftentimes find it. And in the fellowship, which I'm going to take up a little bit later, let me rush on to two other points in this matter of person. And that is developing inner strength. If we're going to be well-balanced, we're going to have to develop inner strength. We were holding a retreat for the businessmen of Highland Park Presbyterian Church, and they want us to hold it on stress. The two things I'd like to say about stress, I think we almost drop into a fad about stress in America. A lot of us think we're on the fast track when we're on the frantic track. Now, I believe in the fast track. Very enjoyable. But I don't believe in the frantic track. I don't believe God called me to be frantic. Now, he may have called me to be very active, but he didn't call me to be frantic. Here's two things. First thing you want to do in order to avoid that is simply broaden your emotional wheelbase. Just broaden your wheelbase. You know, what's the difference in riding a Jeep and a Cadillac? Wheelbase. Jeep hits all the bump, all four wheels at the same time, shakes your liver out. Cadillac comes across, stabilizes, comes across, stabilizes, a better ride. I see so many people with short emotional wheelbases. Children have that. You make a baby mad, he drops down the floor, starts kicking his feet and screaming. You give him what he wants and he jumps up smiling. Now, that's not very different from a lot of vice presidents I've worked with. You know, we just need to learn to stretch the emotional wheelbase. I've always liked that saying that the emperor asked his philosophers to get him. This too shall pass. This too shall pass. If you've read the book, Man's Search for Meaning, Viktor Frankl, a wonderful Jew, head of psychiatry at the University of Vienna, his family was totally wiped out by Hitler's concentration camp, and he lived through it. One of the very few who came out of it. But he wrote that great theory of psychiatry called logotherapy, in which he said man's search is for meaning. Not pleasure, power, or sex, but for meaning. He gave a wonderful definition there. He said ultimate freedom is man's right to choose his attitude. Ultimate freedom is man's right to choose his attitude.